Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of Bottom Line Studio. We are again in Riga Business School. My name is Greg Mathers, and I have a special guest with me today, Karlis Danevich from SEB Bank. Welcome, Karlis. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Greg, for inviting. Thank you.
So Karlis is currently the Chief Risk Officer and a board member at SEB.
That's correct.
You also co-chair a lending committee with the Latvian Finance Association. You also are a board member of the Baltic Institute of Corporate Governance, and you chair the council at Latvia's SOS Children's Village.
Yeah. Right?
So you've got a lot on your plate.
The last thing I'm most proud of, sort of, if I can emphasize.
And you've got a lot on your plate. And not only that, I imagine you're co-chair of the Danevich household.
That as well, yeah.
So how do you keep this all together? And
no, I think the recipe for me is if you really do something that you like, if you see a sense, a purpose for what you're doing, then quite often you gain energy from things. Sort of, even if physically you feel you are putting in long hours, then kind of mentally you don't get tired from those things. Uh-huh. And as I sometimes say to students, it's the same in classes. Sometimes you have less energy after a certain class. Sometimes you are even more energized after a certain class. And the same when it concerns your professional career, sort of after SOS Children's Villages engagements and things. Yes, you might be sometimes physically tired, but from emotional perspective, you really gain a lot because it's very easy to see a sense, a purpose in what you're doing there. Uh-huh. So that's my secret recipe to keep energy level up.
Uh-huh. So you always have a purpose, you know what you're working towards, and
yes, in that sense, I have also been blessed to work in SCB because it's a long-term bank. It's kind of thinking about the long run. It doesn't aim for short-term profits. It's not kind of so-called quarterly capitalist establishment. And then it's also easier, even as a banker, to see the purpose than to see sort of if you grant loans or if you grant loans to the correct companies and they develop, they pay more in taxes and society develops. And at the end of the day, that also uh-huh. makes you feel good, and the energy level is not depleted, or at least is not depleted as fast as otherwise would have been. Uh-huh.
Okay. So, Karlis, if I count correctly, next year is 20 years at SEB.
Is that correct? That's uh-huh. quite a lot. Some say it's too long, but it still feels like yesterday sometimes. Uh-huh.
And your first job there was as a credit analyst?
My first job was an accident, frankly speaking. I was sort of a bit exhausted from studying and working at the same time, which is very typical for Latvians my age or 20 years ago. And I was kind of driving to a summer place, and I received a call from my study mate, and he was saying, "Look, there is a job opening in SCB. I know you are sort of planning a bit of a vacation in summer, but it's really important for me. I work there and I want to see you part of our team. So could you please go to this interview?" And frankly speaking, I went there only because of him. So uh-huh. otherwise, I would not have looked at this possibility. And needless to say that I'm very grateful to him. And for me, that's a reminder that in order to succeed, you also need to be humble, and you need to realize that luck is an important part of any accomplishment as well. Of course, it's a lot of hard work. Of course, it's a lot of sort of investment in yourself, but luck is also something that you need to have on your side.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, but you started as a credit analyst, is
yes.
that right? Which means you're evaluating risk.
Correct.
So now you've spent 20 years in the bank, and you still have the same job.
it looks a bit like that. No, but it's more exciting than that. And we have had a couple of crises in between, and it has been fascinating for a risk manager as myself. And frankly speaking, by now, if I look back at my almost 20 years, I would say I'm by far the most rotated person within Baltic organization. I have been sort of a credit analyst. I have been head of credit department. I have been living and working in Sweden, part of sort of covering emerging markets and other geographies for SCB Group, including Russia, Ukraine, most of African countries, by the way, as well. I have been heading client relationship department, which is taking care of business side of the bank, corporate banking side of the bank. I have been chief financial officer of the bank. I have also been head of AML and KYC in Baltics during a few years and fairly turbulent years. And now I'm back to my sort of initial position. So it sounds, it hasn't been exciting, but believe me, it has been way more exciting than I could have ever imagined.
Wow, that's great. Okay. All right. Well, as a credit analyst, you were an employee and then you moved into a management position. How did that work? How was that transition?
I always keep saying to students that early years are always the most difficult ones because you sort of really need to sort of do three things good at the same time. So you need to be a great specialist. You can't lose that part. You really need to stand on that leg firmly, and you sort of need to be smart and invest in your technical skills. Then you need to sort of already prove that not only you can manage your agenda and you can manage work for yourself, but you can also sort of help others and can manage work for others and can represent others, can be sort of a leader that is bridging the team with the rest of the organization, and also was studying at RBS at the same time. So you really need to manage those three things, and that was maybe the most hard period in my life, the hardest period in my life professionally.
But how did you make that transition from managing yourself to now you have to be responsible for other people's performance?
I would say, at least in my context, and I have afterwards made a more general observation about that, it's sort of sometimes a bit easier if you sort of grow within your respective domain, if you're the smartest specialist that takes interest in other people and can really manage your work in a good manner, and you have some energy left for managing others, then you can sort of naturally evolve in that role. Afterwards, it becomes harder and harder, where you lose this sort of touch with being the smartest expert or one of the smartest experts, and you suddenly manage people that are smarter than you, frankly speaking, and you can sort of say, okay, I'm not the smartest one in any of the fields that my team members are covering, but still, I need to be their manager. So that's then the next level challenge. So. If it kind of happens gradually, if you initially learn to be a manager where you are also a good expert, maybe it's even easier, and then you can move on being a manager elsewhere. Uh-huh. And again, I was sort of, I maybe shouldn't say this, but joining Riga Business School, I was a bit skeptical when it comes to soft topics. I was very much loving statistics and sort of the hard part of it, but I was a bit skeptical about HR management and soft skills, and I always thought, is this really something you can learn, or you really need to learn it by doing, or you can learn it during classes? But when you have this ability to sort of listen to lectures and then afterwards connect it with reality, contextualize it in your own reality and try it out, becoming a new manager, it actually really helps. It actually really helps. So in a way, that was the big surprise for me in RBS, that soft skills can be, to an extent at least, learned and developed. With all the case studies we had in your classes and in other classes, talking with your sort of peers, reflecting on things you are doing every day at work, and then, you can really feel you can learn things and you can maybe sort of accelerate your development.
So it was in business class and business school, though, that you came to appreciate soft skills. And before that, it was you were more focused on hard skills.
I'm a mathematician, sort of coming from a math school. So I always thought, okay, give me the right answer. I will calculate it. I will know it faster or better than others. And this is not how it works when you engage with other human individuals. Then you really need to develop your
They're
soft skills.
They're not just numbers.
They're not just numbers, and frankly speaking, you will be rejected by them if you see world only through numbers, definitely.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, you went through a series of positions. First you were working, to reduce the risk for the bank, then with an internal focus, then you shifted to an external focus where you're trying to help clients, right? You moved into
business
client
position.
Management.
Yep. Right?
So how was that transition?
That transition was actually surprisingly good for me because I always felt sort of a lot of trust from my manager, and that's something we haven't yet touched upon, but I think it's sometimes more important what is your manager than in which organization you are working. because of course you will sort of have mistakes, you will have failures, and if you don't have a supportive manager when you go through this learning curve, then it's not a pleasant experience, and the chances of you giving up or chances of you not learning from your mistakes are a bit higher. For me, moving to business side, it was sort of, I would say, an easier context because I just returned from my time in Sweden, so I had a good kind of platform in a very much Swedish organization, a lot of trust, a lot of visibility, as well as mandate to try to change culture from being a bit more sales organization, which maybe was the case for banks before the previous crisis, or previous crisis, I should now say, into a more banker's mindset and risk mindset. And that was fitting me quite well. And yeah, after some time, you sort of realize, okay, my job maybe here is done, and some others are more natural business people. And me as a more mathematician, analytical and introvert person, by the way, I was kind of happy to move back to supporting units after okay. this change of okay. culture.
So yeah, because it's an interesting dynamic, because as a credit analyst and working on the credit side, your job is really to protect the bank and make sure that the bank is taken care of. When you move to the business side, now your job is to take care of the client and make sure that they're, and there's natural tension there between those two.
That is spot on, but at least what I can say to myself currently is that having that experience has helped me out tremendously. To have more empathy for people that are business persons and salespeople, and to really understand that, well, frankly speaking, life is quite often more difficult for them. They really need to be the positive ones. They quite often get rejection from client, get rejection within the bank, and they really now need to have a lot of inner energy, strength to kind of stand up and continue going. So without this experience, I would not have realized how hard it is sort of emotionally to be a good salesperson. This is what Americans are usually good at, sort of smiling and selling and not being concerned of receiving rejection. Average person in Latvia is quite traumatized by every rejection.
A couple of years of that and you were ready to go back to support position.
Yeah.
Okay. But eventually then you moved on to the board. And when you got onto the board, what was the biggest change for you, or the biggest surprise?
It is initially a big shock, because that is sort of a specific place in a bank that you have always sort of thought, okay, maybe I will be there one day, but not as young as I was back at time. And yeah, you sort of suddenly discover it is a bit different. I really need to take more holistic responsibility. People are more looking at me and how I'm interacting with others, and I cannot hide behind saying, okay, this is my responsibility and this is where it stops. You really need to sort of have a broader responsibility, and yeah, convince yourself that, okay, now it's way more serious, because you are sort of in one way responsible for all of it as a member of a team, but still.
So on this path from credit analyst up to board member, and I guess first you were chief financial officer.
That was this first position in the board, yeah.
Right. CFO. So looking back, what were some of the biggest mistakes you made?
The biggest mistake, and I have learned to share it. The biggest mistake was a bad credit that I approved, and that's a story I really cherish, and that's maybe a reason why I'm still in SEB, strangely so. But long story short, that was a big mistake I made, and of course it's kind of group of people that make mistakes. But still, if you're chairing a credit committee, you do feel a lot of personal responsibility if things go south, if things really sort of unravel. And I was so shocked by this mistake, and there was sort of a financial crisis and a lot of sort of stress and tension. I tried to resign. I had a lot of sympathy for the boss of my boss, a very old Swedish guy. He's now retired, but I had a lot of personal sympathy for him, and I felt he was a bit of a mentor in a silent agreement also to me. And having so much respect to him, I said to him, "I have made a terrible mistake. I want to resign. I really can't look you in the eyes. I can't see how I'm able to continue." He told me a beautiful story, which I now feel I sort of need to share also with others. He sort of looked at me and he said, "No, I will not accept your resignation." And he told the story, allegedly, of a guy, a vice president in IBM, that had lost a lot of money for IBM, and sort of his boss calls him in the office, and he's about to get fired, but the boss sort of says, "Okay, you will be promoted to a bigger division." And the guy who made a big mistake, he says, "Haven't you heard the news that I just made the biggest mistake we have ever made in IBM, and you're now promoting me? Maybe there's some mistake." And allegedly, the boss of IBM said, "No, no, no, we have just invested so much money in your education that we cannot allow you to go away. We really need to keep you. We feel you have the right attitude. You really sort of have learned from that mistake. And for us, it's very important to keep you and to earn back the money we have invested in your education." And sort of this boss of mine told me this story and said, "No way, I will accept your resignation." I tried once again next day. And then he said, "No, no, think from my perspective. I have a person that has made a big mistake, but I really believe this person has learned something, and this person in the long run will be asset for the bank. Or I can easily sort of accept your resignation, and in comes a new guy. And you think he will or she will be always perfect and never make any mistakes. So which you would choose in my place? If you really think for next 20 years, would you pick a person that has made a mistake, regrets and has learned? Or would you pick a fresh guy or girl every time someone makes a mistake and start from the scratch?" And then that actually convinced me that, okay, it might be something I don't realize at that point in time, but in the long run, it is important to accept mistakes and to have this psychological safety and courage also, yeah, to empower people around you that making mistakes is fine. Of course, if you make the same mistake 2, 3, or 4 times, then that's not fine anymore. One shouldn't trivialize that. And actually, sort of, yeah, I have reflected on that story numerous times. And what also sort of helped me in difficult moments, I was very much inspired and also sort of a person that to a large extent raised me was my grandmother. And she was in charge of a children hospital unit, which took care of kids after car crashes. So she was chief surgeon in that department, which takes care after big traumas or car crashes of kids. And that sort of always puts things in perspective, that okay, I made a mistake, and sort of she was still alive at that point in time, and she said, "Well, guess what, I also made a mistake. But you know what was the price of my mistake? The price of my mistake was maybe a death of a person." Mm-hmm. And then also sort of as a doctor, she reflected, "But what do you do as a doctor after a mistake? You drink yourself to death, you resign, you don't go back to work. Is life a better place without you being able to overcome it? Or still you need to sort of pull yourself together and realize, okay, I can't fix that situation. I made a mistake, but I will try to make world a better place by sort of learning from my mistake and going back to work." And that was also, frankly speaking, inspiration for me. Then I thought, okay, if doctors can do it, then well, in finance and in banks, you should always be able to pull yourself together, even after painful mistakes.
That kind of puts things in perspective, right?
That has helped me a lot. And some of my colleagues, I know they are annoyed by me reflecting to kind of what doctors are doing, or sometimes kind of giggling that it's not as serious as you think, because really serious things happen back at the hospital. But I really have this reflection in my head, and it really has helped me.
Uh-huh. So all of this, though, reflects back on this idea of soft skills.
As well, yeah.
Right? And absolutely. And so what impact did his speech really have on you?
I would say,
and your relationship with the bank.
I would say that created loyalty that lasts to this very day. And mm-hmm. I was so much impressed and humbled by that treatment, thinking that, okay, I deserve to resign. And I would, frankly speaking, I would understand if I would be fired. So and to experience quite the contrary, that really creates a sort of very strong bond. And I also sort of always felt I need to give back. I have sort of received more than I have been able to give back. So I need to give back to the place I'm working. And especially if I can in some day be in a position where I can sort of have such a positive impact as that person had on me, I would be a blessed person. So I'm sure I haven't succeeded yet, but I'll keep trying, and I'm sure it has inspired me to be sort of a better manager and to sort of have empathy for people that make mistakes. Sometimes maybe even too much empathy, but yeah, that's an important part of my professional experience.
Okay, all right. So in Latvia, I work with a lot of companies, and one of the most common problems I run across is lack of engagement with middle managers. When there's problems, they wait for somebody else to solve it, or they just take it to their boss who solves it. They don't take initiative, and they wait to be told what to do. How does this play out in SEB?
The former CEO of SEB, the big CEO in a group, Annika Falkengren, she sometimes referred it to the problem of permafrost. She said, okay, we sort of understand that the sun shines here and everything should be fine, and we understand that somewhere there are people that want to affect things, but then there is permafrost layer of middle management. As you said, and being at that point in time part of this permafrost, I always challenged myself, and I always thought that you need to dare, and you need to sort of really try to make things better. And yeah, I have had some colleagues around that have been also equally brave, and you sort of one colleague, for example, from marketing, I remember she was saying that if you want to be a good brand, you need to have two fans and one person that hates you. And maybe that's also the same to break through this permafrost, that it's fine that two people will understand and appreciate what you do, and then one against every two will really not understand and will hate that yeah, now you are sort of breaking through some ice and not doing things in the right manner. So that's actually quite liberating feeling when you understand that it's fine that you will not be loved and liked by everyone, because for quite some time you really want to please everyone and you really want to work with everyone and connect with everyone, and then you have this liberating feeling that, well, even in marketing they say it's fine to have this ratio two against one.
So what do you do with that one person that doesn't agree with you, doesn't, you know, is against what you're doing?
No, there's no universal recipe, but when it gets sometimes really hard and you feel a lot of resistance, then I actually listen to the speech of Theodore Roosevelt. It's one of his most famous speeches. It's called Man in the Arena. And he speaks about persons that are in the arena in sports that really try to accomplish something. And he says there's no accomplishment short of error. There's no accomplishment without errors, without having your face marred in dust and you have a bloody nose and you're really bruised and struggling and you're quite often losing. If you're sort of playing ice hockey or soccer or whatever, every professional sportsman would say you quite often end up losing. But at least, Theodore Roosevelt says, at least you are not like those timid souls that know neither victory nor defeat, the ones that are sitting and watching how others are trying to play the game. And then also in professional context, you try to encourage yourself and you try to think, okay, I was in the arena, I lost this fight, or maybe that was not a wise fight, but at least I tried to change things. I was not sitting back, drinking beer and criticizing others that tried to do something. And yes, maybe many around me looked at me as a bit weird guy that is sort of trying to be in the arena and accomplish something, but at least I sort of tell to myself that that's the right attitude. Even if you have lost that particular game, that's still the right attitude. Not to be like those timid souls that know neither victory nor defeat. It's a very powerful speech.
Yeah. So that's the perspective from being one of the middle managers. But from the top now, how what do you do about that permafrost? How do you engage these people? And are they engaged enough, do you think, at SEB?
I quite often think that I have been thoroughly blessed by people in my team. So at least in sort of my respective responsibility, I haven't felt that it's a big resistance or people are against the need for change. And again, I need to be frank, I think it is a lot of good luck as well. Coming back from Sweden and leading business unit, shortly after crisis where there is a lot of willingness to change the culture mm-hmm. and to sort of approach things in a positive way. Being a chief financial officer when we are changing IT systems and there's a lot of support, a lot of willingness to change. I have been lucky and blessed being responsible for AML and KYC just when kind of regulators have all this pressure and there's a lot of willingness to invest and to change again. So then you don't have this resistance. So I keep saying to myself, I still haven't learned it the hard way, and I'm not sure if I would learn it the hard way, because it has been a good coincidence for me to come in where you really feel the change is ripe and there's not a big resistance for whatever you need to change. And in between sort of being like now chief risk officer or some years ago also chief risk officer, if it's plain sailing, then it's plain sailing. You don't need to fix what is not broken. If the TV is working, you don't sort of come in with your wisdom and now try to sort of replug it or try to really change it or say that it has some resistance to you. Then you show a lot of empathy, it's working, it's functioning. How can I add some value? How can I sort of help people develop, help people improve? So more of that. So in between all those change projects, it has been also a plain sailing where you really don't need to mess up with all the good things people are doing. And you need to be humble. I really believe also in this philosophy that a leader eats last. In a way, leader, it's a well-described phenomenon that also among packs of animals, they respect that someone is sort of a bit more senior or a leader if that someone defends them, supports them, helps them, and is ready to take higher risks to defend them. That person is ready to take, or that animal is ready to take higher risks. Wolves that are sort of pack leaders, they would be the ones that would eat last, would take higher risks, and would protect their pack. I think people have a similar feeling that unless it's really sort of a crisis manager, unless it's really a change where you need to sort of help them be more decisive and instigate some change, when it's plain sailing, then that's the best you can do. You can be sort of quite often a humble servant that helps them, protects them, takes higher risks, defends them when they make mistakes, if they have the right attitude, helps them grow and sort of sincerely wish them well. And the gratitude you get from people that outgrow you, and I have really been in a position where I have said to some of my former teammates to whom I have been manager, I have been in a position, and that's a fantastic position, to say to them, I think you're better than I am, and I really love to conclude it, and I really sort of am happy that you are now growing and moving elsewhere. It's a really nice feeling.
Uh-huh. It's like sending your kids off to school. All right. Well, my next question was actually going to be about leadership because you're in a leadership position. And I wanted to ask you, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's a lot about those things that we described already. And it is really taking care of your team, being a good listener. For students in some leadership guest lectures, I sometimes use this comparison of Napoleon, that Napoleon shocked Europe for 15 or 20 years and no one realized what this short guy is up to and how come he is such a military genius. And afterwards, they slowly sort of learned that Napoleon is always on a horse. He's always sort of riding to his guys on the left side and asking, do you want to attack in the morning, in the evening, from the left side or the right side? Then he's going to sort of artillery guys and asking to them, okay, do you want to do it from a hill or you feel it's sort of a bit muddy there, we need to do it elsewhere. Before him, generals were really sitting in a tent, thinking that they are the wisest, smoking something and sort of coming out and saying, okay, this is the plan, you will just implement it. But a good leader, again, I have nothing sort of for Napoleon or against Napoleon, but a good leader is a bit like Napoleon in that sense, that connects with reality, learns from his team, supports his team, cares about his soldiers or his team, and really is and then putting up or helping to put up the bigger plan if he can.
So you're saying Napoleon was an early proponent of participative management?
I would say so, yeah. And it's, for me, it's fascinating. We all study history, but we sort of don't notice those changes, that suddenly sort of when you describe a military general, he is not anymore sitting in a tent and sort of with the wrong maps, but he is on a horse suddenly.
So what are how do you approach developing somebody? Because you said, you know, for you it's really important when they get to the point where they're maybe better than you. So what is it? How do you, I guess my real question is in Latvia there's a challenge of keeping people, getting people, finding good people, keeping them. You know, turnover can be really high because there's lots of opportunities. It's a labor's market here.
Yeah, no, I think, again, I have been blessed because if you have the right people, then they are happy if they are treated well. They are not sort of aiming at all the times for the highest salary or biggest thrill or this or that for people and for everyone. For me as well, it's important that my boss sincerely wishes me well, takes care of my development, is ready to send me to some training, is ready to sort of support me in some situations. So I have really sort of learned that those things matter a lot, and people really appreciate that you show this genuine care for them. It's as simple as that, but it's not kind of universal or it's not a specific answer for every situation, because specific answer depends on a person. And I have had situations in my team, and this is a story from 2 or 3 months ago. A person says, I don't want to be on a stage. I feel I have received a lot of praise. There's one thing I expect from you as my manager. I don't want to be on stage. I don't want to receive any kind of corporate bullshit prizes about best employee of the year or this and that. Then you need to listen to that. First of all, it's kind of nice that you have created psychological safety that your colleague says this to you. And secondly, well, who are you to sort of know better? Then you need to be a humble servant and you need to listen even to that demand. Uh-huh. And sometimes it's someone sort of has a big ego and wants to sort of shine and show things and all that. And then it's fine. Then you need to be more flexible yourself and take a step back and sort of allow that person maybe to shine a bit brighter than you otherwise would sort of instigate it. So it really depends on the situation. But this genuine care, genuine willingness to help that person, ability to listen to that person, that's important.
Uh-huh. So with all of this, what's a typical day like at work?
Typical day at work? No, I would say for me a typical day always starts by reading The Economist. That's my thing, and I'm quite proud of that. That for 20 plus years now, I have been reading it from the first page till the last page. So I would always say the work doesn't start at when it starts. It starts when you invest something in yourself, when you educate yourself, when you go to RBS, when you read The Economist in my case. Be my guest, whatever is your recipe, but you do something that sort of starts your day. So for me, it always starts like almost an hour on average reading The Economist. And that already sets you in a mood that sort of, okay, there's business section, finance section, this and that. And you start to sort of already a bit get your mechanism running. And afterwards, it very much depends on the day. But yeah, it would be credit committees, it would be interaction with other colleagues. It would be sometimes quite often we don't have any time for kind of strategic thinking. So then you really would need to almost reserve it in your calendar that, okay, I have this challenge, but I can't solve it during noise of all the meetings. So maybe it's fine that I book 1 hour and then I sort of work on this strategic challenge on cyber threats, on other risk aspects. Now it's very topical to speak about non-financial threats. So one thing is to manage quality of credit portfolio, to be like an investment manager that manages to whom we are granting loans and to whom we are not granting loans. But then it's another sort of hat you need to put on in order to think of non-financial risks, operational risks, cyber threats, certain other sort of aspects. Market and liquidity risks maybe are not the biggest in this part of the world, but the operational risks are always part of every day's agenda. And they say in risk management that if you sort of have failed to prepare for a certain risk, then either this is lack of imagination or lack of experience. And then you always need to strive to, okay, to use your imagination to think what can possibly go wrong. And sometimes colleagues would say, okay, now you sound a bit crazy. This really can't happen. And then you say, okay, maybe now my imagination went a bit too far. And educate yourself in terms of experience. They say smart people learn from their own mistakes, but in banking it's good if you can also learn from others' mistakes. If you have Swiss bank recently had a major operational risk incident, and then you try to invest time in reading about it instead of learning about it, and hopefully learning also from other people's mistakes.
Uh-huh. So you keep saying that your colleagues sometimes think you're a little bit crazy. is that part of why you've been so successful? Is being a little bit crazy?
That's actually a good point, because also I have learned during at least last 10 years, hopefully, when I come in as a manager for a new team, to be very open about my drawbacks. I might be shy with my peers or even sometimes with my bosses to be open about my drawbacks, but I would never be shy with my team to openly say, okay, I come in here. Here is what I will try to do to help you, and here is what I really am not good at. And I suck at details, I suck at sometimes I'm forgetful, sometimes I would miss how difficult it is in implementation, because I would be more the visionary guy, seeing, okay, we need to do it, but would not have enough empathy for the actual blood, sweat and tears it takes to implement it. So. And what I have discovered is the more open you are about your drawbacks, the less people would giggle about your drawbacks. And that's a nice feeling that you're not laughed at, or you're laughed at when you are in the room,
in
at
the
least,
room, yes.
Hopefully. And guess what? They are also nice people. They cover up for you. And they point that, okay, you were saying that you struggle with details. This is actually a situation where we need you to roll up your sleeves and get into details. We know this is something what is not your strength, but in this case, please take this document, read it from the first letter to the last, and please write some sentences there in yourself. And then, yes, of course, that was my weakness. I could not have seen it myself, but since I have been open about drawbacks, then I'm pushed to try to mitigate them or to try to solve them.
Uh-huh. So again, back to humility is,
I think that's
recognizing you're not the perfect manager.
I think that's wise, because if I also look back at situations where you are really struggling and you feel alone or you feel you are in a burnout or close to burnout, those are situations where you try to be very strong and where you try to outsmart others, overpower others, where you lose connection with others, you haven't been humble enough, you haven't been connecting with others. So those are the dangerous territories, and those have been my mistakes. And of course, my 20 years are also full of mistakes.
So what challenges are ahead?
What challenges are ahead? I always think of career, and whether someone believes me or not, it's true for me. I always think that if you're driving from point A to point B, then you need to know, okay, where are you driving to? So for me, those are my values, what I cherish, what I like, what I appreciate. But if you're driving from point A to point B and it takes 10 kilometers, it doesn't matter if you figure out after 1 kilometer I will have a road that bends to the left side or to the right side. That really doesn't matter. So if you are strong with your values and your beliefs, then and if you really drive and you take a look at the road, you try to do as best as you can, whatever comes at your disposal, then maybe it's fine not to overinvest in thinking about what lies after 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers. When it comes, then you take care of that. So I have never, believe it or not, but I have never had a career planning exercise or said I want to do this or that. I grab things when they come and I try to really invest my heart and my mind into that. And another wonderful coincidence was also SOS Children's Villages. I think one distinguished marketing colleague of mine, she was together with CEO of the bank at that time, thinking that, okay, we can send Carlis as our representative to that organization, because he seems to be active. Maybe he's too active. He's sometimes annoying. So maybe we can send him to use his energy there. And we were largest donators. And it became really, I dare to say, a professional love of my life, SOS Children's Villages. So it became much more than just a work and just an SCB mission. And
So tell us about it, since that's what you're most proud of.
No, it started by me not saying no to some colleagues that said, okay, we are biggest donator.
But tell us about the village. What's the purpose of it? And
now it's sort of in Latvia. We are running two villages, and essentially, sort of, it's easier if I say how the idea originated. Our idea originated in Austria, and then it spread to Germany after Second World War. When one wise Austrian guy, he was saying, wait a minute, there's a bit of problem. Streets are full with kids that are unattended. Male guys are not returning. And there are mothers that are struggling alone with their own kids. And other kids are completely without any parents. And plus, we have houses that are empty. So how can we solve it if we as a society could pay salary to that mother to be mother, to live in that house and take also other kids with her, then maybe we are starting to heal the society after Second World War. And it started out as simple as that, and it has it has continued as a sort of mission for many of us in many countries across the globe. And in Latvia, as I sort of quite often say, for us, the Second World War ended in 1991. So the real healing process, the process where kids are not just numbers in institutions, if they are abandoned by their parents, it started only then. And then, this organization came to Latvia and has been doing good things here as well. But it's much more than just villages. I could talk for hours about it.
Okay,
but the main mission is that sort of to pay salary to most of the time ladies to take care of kids that are unattended, and to make it sort of professional. Of course, you invest your heart there and all that. But if you do charity with professional business standards, then it's even more powerful. That's what we have learned.
Great. Wow. So last thing is, somebody who's thinking about maybe coming to RBS for a bachelor's degree or for an MBA, what would you tell them?
Now, for bachelor's, I would say that's a no-brainer. Of course, that's something you need if you are curious about IT, technology, finance, economics, business, so all of those fields plus many more. If you're curious about that's a no-brainer. I sometimes sort of sense in some discussions with people that when it comes to MBA part, then it helps if you have a possibility already at work or platform where you can contextualize those learnings. Because to sit in a leadership class and to read case studies and all that, that's all fine. But it's also sort of how a person's brain works. We remember things which we are able to contextualize with our own life. So if you are able to have MBA, plus you really see that you have some managerial challenges and assignments at work, it helps. If you're only sort of bogged down as an expert, maybe it would be too theoretical and maybe you wouldn't be able to kind of fully grasp that.
So building on that then, would you suggest to somebody who's straight out of a bachelor's program that they should go get a job for a while, try to be a manager for a while, and then get an MBA?
I don't want to disappoint you, but but in a way, yes. And this being Latvia, of course, people quite often work in parallel, or they have some managerial or even maybe leadership sort of tasks in between. And again, it's not that you need to be having a title of manager to be a manager. And there's no such title as leader. We all are managers and leaders, sort of. But it just depends what's. Are we managers of our own life? It's good if we are. Are we leaders of our own life? It's good if we can manage that. Maybe we are sort of leading and inspiring others through some projects. And again, this is not a title that anyone gives to you. So look a bit broader on that one. But where you feel curious, okay, I can manage my life. I can maybe even lead my life. And how can I sort of leave some impact on others? And maybe there's something I can learn from the wisest of them all, then yes, that's definitely a point you need to sort of think of MBA. But if you're really bogged down as an expert and you don't care about other people, and sometimes that's also fine, then maybe that's not the correct path for you.
Okay.
And that's actually, I'm also sort of quite often asked, how come I remember so many quotes and so many things? And that's again, back to this ability to contextualize it with your own life. If you hear something or if you read something and you put book aside and you think a bit about your colleagues, about your professional setting, even if you're reading Dostoevsky, there's a lot of psychology and beautiful psychology there. Read one page, put it aside, and sort of think about how it resonates mm-hmm. with your personal life, with your professional life. Then you will remember things that you have read. And the same about sort of MBA or what you learn. If you're able to sort of put it a bit aside, digest it, contextualize it, then you will remember it. Then it will be more powerful. If it's like running, okay, I've done this, then you will very fast forget what you have learned. Yeah. Then you don't get maximum benefit. But I guess you're also quite good in sort of forcing people to contextualize with group works, case studies and all that. So in a way, they are forced to contextualize.
I mean, one of the important things you've talked about is slowing down. Right? We're so fast all the time with work and all the stress, and you have to be able to take time to slow down.
That's also a big, big wisdom. And sometimes people think I'm sort of a bit... Not even daydreaming or sort of a bit aside from everyday struggles or practicalities in one field or the other. And I can say that's a deliberate choice, because there's so much noise that as they lately also teach in strategy classes, that strategy is sometimes more what you are not doing than what you are doing, because we all have like to-do lists, 20, 30 items, and we all think of strategies in business, in personal life and all that. But more powerful strategic statement is what you're not doing. And then again, just to give it an example with my life and to contextualize it with my life, strategic decision is not to read Financial Times, not to read daily stuff, but to read The Economist.
Uh-huh.
Because the frequency is once per week, it's a bit more reflective. You're not there in the everyday noise. You have made a strategic choice not to be there in tactical everyday noise, because stock markets in Monday go up, in Tuesday they fall, and Wednesday they again go up and all that. But then you make a strategic choice that, okay, this is not for me. This is maybe for traders in London or New York, but not for me. And then I keep away from those things. And the same in professional setting, that sometimes it will be hurtful, you will be blamed, you will not be understood by everyone, but you deliberately retreat from certain things and you're not as present there as you maybe sort of would want to be from emotional perspective. But if it's a strategic choice, then respect that one mm-hmm. and adhere to that one.
Ah, great. Well, now we have a tactical decision to make. We're out of time. So thanks for joining me
thank
today.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's really been a pleasure. And as always, I learned something from you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thanks for everybody for tuning in. And see you next time on Bottom Line Studio.